On this week's On the Media, we stretch our imaginations to ponder a future when humanity is cut off from its electronic records, a digital dark age.
The internet is a peculiar beast. It remembers things that you wish it would forget, and it forgets things you wish it would remember.
A big solar storm has happened.
If it had hit us, we'd be living in the 1800s right now.
We just expected that we had some sort of guardian angel of techno-archaeology that would just solve our problem in the most absurd way possible.
There was a sudden power surge in northern Quebec, just a fraction of a second, and then, like a big circuit breaker, the whole system shut down.
Isn't DNA itself a digital storage medium for information?
It's not all bad. Duct tape has survived the meltdown of the human race. It's very positive.
By losing everything, I could start over again.
Vin Cerf, Margaret Atwood, Solar Flares, DNA Dust, after this.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, we're engaging in some chillingly informed speculation. What would happen if we as a species lost access to our electronic records? What if, either by the slow creep of technological obsolescence or sudden cosmic disaster, we no longer could draw from the well of knowledge accrued through the ages? What if we fell into a digital dark age? We do know that the march of progress, the steady extinction of audio cassettes and videotapes, floppy disks and operating systems, has already extinguished parts of your personal history, because you told us.
This is David Gable in New York City, and the loss that comes to mind is wondering why I ever got rid of that little tiny cassette that used to be inside 1980s phone answering machines, because I kept it for a long time after my boyfriend died of AIDS in 1988, and I kept the last message I had from him. And it was not a particularly interesting message, it just was his voice. And I kept thinking, what's this cassette ever going to fit? And the day came when the machine just broke, and I tossed it and got rid of that little tiny cassette. And I wish I hadn't. Because it would have been nice to hear his voice at this point.
In our eagerness to embrace the limitless storage capacity of new technology, we are losing the documents of our past. This week, a guide to the once and future digital dark age. The first scenario is not speculation. It happened.
As far back as 1990, the New York Times described NASA's massive archive from early space flights as edging closer to the brink of technological extinction. The agency hadn't thoroughly cataloged 1.2 million magnetic tape reels of images and data from 260 scientific missions. Hundreds of thousands of tapes were kept under, quote, deplorable conditions. In fact, NASA says the original tapes of the Apollo moonwalk probably were erased and reused in the early 1980s. That grainy image you've seen of the giant leap for mankind is really a copy of a copy. So are most photos from space.
I remember the first image from Lunar Orbiter 1 that showed the Earth rising above the lunar surface. Now, technically it was setting, but it became called Earthrise.
Keith Cowing is co-founder of the Lunar Orbiter Image Recovery Project, or LORP, which endeavors to rescue 1960s NASA data, such as that iconic image, Earthrise. You've seen that black and white photo snapped in 1966. In the foreground, the vast craters of the moon, and floating above, where the lunar horizon fades into black, a bright crescent of the Earth with white swirls of atmosphere. When Keith Cowing first saw it, he was a young teenager.
As a matter of fact, I was getting in the car to go see the film 2001 for the very first time in theaters, and I had a National Geographic book with me, and the frontispiece was that photo. So for me and many people my age, this was really seared in my memory. And the way that we saw it, or at least I saw it, it had these lines through it, and it was pretty primitive, but this is the first time anybody had really seen Earth in a context as part of the Earth-Moon system.
The photo looked primitive because at the time, NASA's ability to collect data outstripped its ability to clearly display it or even see it. Images of the moon's surface taken by the five lunar orbiter spacecraft were so large, they were beamed back to Earth in sections as data, then recorded to magnetic tape reels and printed out on photographic paper, and then photographed again.
They had these giant pieces of newsprint in an old church or a factory, and they just put them together and they hung them there. Then they say, all right, now we can kind of understand how this looks and photograph it again. So, you know, right off the bat, you're losing some resolution. And because of the way that photographic film worked and so forth, you get these variations towards the edges, the sort of zebra striping.
Once the lunar orbiter had fulfilled its mission to find a suitable spot for the Apollo 11 landing in 1969, nearly all of the thousands of 2-inch magnetic tape reels it recorded were either discarded or reused. That is, except for just one set, stored away in protective canisters sealed with whale oil.
We don't really use whale oil anymore, but that's sort of the secret sauce, apparently, to what helped keep these alive. Somebody just thought ahead, did precisely what you need to do to keep these tapes in pristine condition.
One full set of the original tape reels, with their whale oil, were passed around for nearly five decades, narrowly escaping destruction. In 2006, they resurfaced again, and LORP was born. But what good are tapes if you don't have a refrigerator-sized Ampex FR-900 tape drive to play them on? Nearly all of those machines had been lost as well. But a former NASA employee, Nancy Evans, had miraculously used her own money to buy four of them for safekeeping.
She stored them in a barn in her backyard in Central California, which is nice and dry. And when we contacted her, her daughter now ran the place, and she was a holistic veterinarian. And when we went there to pick them out, there were the drives, nice and just sitting there covered with dust and farm animals walking around.
The early history of space exploration stowed in a barn.
So we just fortuitously had two independent paths that caused the tapes and the drives to still exist decades later. Now we just had to make them work.
It was just the beginning of digital resurrection as Andy Hardy movie. Hey kids, let's salvage our scientific legacy. The team happened upon an air conditioning repairman whose brother had worked with Ampex drives and could help rebuild them. The gang shopped for spare parts on eBay and at Radio Shack. NASA offered them an empty McDonald's in Silicon Valley to work in, and they renamed it McMoons. And they found documentation of a mathematical formula needed to demodulate the images.
We just expected that we had some sort of guardian angel of techno-archaeology that would just solve our problem in the most absurd way possible. And we cobbled it all together. And then in a scene that was just like out of the movie Contact, where they're playing with a transmission that was being sent back by aliens, and they said, turn it this way, turn it that way. Suddenly, there was the picture.
Can you clean it up anymore than that fish?
I'm working on it.
We saw, in this case, the white of space, which is the black of space, because these images were negative, and then the darkness of the moon. And when you flipped it, there it was. There was the image we were looking for, just like that.
The team published its first recovered image in 2008, a streak-free version of Earthrise, seen in higher resolution than ever before. LORP has since rescued thousands of other images, but this was more than an exercise in nostalgia. The project has rescued clear images of the Antarctic, captured by satellite in the 60s, and NASA has found reels containing ozone levels from the 1970s, both troves of baseline data for understanding the effect and rates of ice melt and climate change.
So we're half a century late, but, you know, later is better than never.
Keith, please tell me that today in 2015, NASA and other government agencies that are marshaling gigantic scientific projects are not going to leave it for future techno-archaeologists to jerry-rig solutions, that there is a plan in place to preserve what we are spending billions to discover?
Well, no and yes. We've got spacecraft that generate terabytes of data like on a daily basis, and it's being stored on hard drives, and hard drives fail. And if you store it on DVDs, well, over time, the plastic degrades. And so archiving all this stuff, what do you archive it on? So I fear that, you know, we're going to be losing stuff. And unless the programs specifically say you're going to save your material in a certain way, it may be lost.
Keith Cowing is a former NASA employee and is now editor of the blog NASA Watch. He was co-founder of the Lunar Orbit Image Recovery Project, but has since left the team.
Coming up, Once we wrote important stuff on parchment made from calfskin called vellum. Now, an internet visionary wants to make digital vellum.
This is On the Media.
Hey, podcast listeners. We want you to subscribe to our nifty little newsletter. And if you do, you'll be entered to win a signed copy of Bob's comic novel, Bedfellows, and my critically acclaimed graphic media manifesto, The Influencing Machine. There'll be 5 winners. Of course, you're already entered if you're already a subscriber, whether you like it or not. Just go to onthemedia.org to subscribe. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As we'll hear more about shortly, it's plenty terrifying to imagine some cosmological event suddenly robbing us of our ability to access that hilarious video of Uncle Ralph in his scuba gear. But what if the demise of all we hold digitally dear is a disaster of human design, a gradual, rolling crisis already set in motion? Internet pioneer Vint Cerf is trying to halt that destructive trajectory with a concept he calls digital vellum. But it won't be easy.
I found that the internet is a peculiar beast. It remembers things that you wish it would forget, and it forgets things you wish it would remember.
Cerf and other tech thinkers have given the problem of encroaching digital obsolescence the ominous moniker...
Bitrot. It's a serious problem, and it comes in several flavors. The first one is the physical media in which we store digital content. It isn't clear how many years they will last, but even if they lasted for, 20 years or 30 years, there is this question of what can read them.
I'm preparing for my daughter's wedding and have a whole mess of VHS tapes, which I wanted to harvest for their nostalgia value, but I don't have a VHS player to play them on.
But let's pretend that, in fact, you've been very careful to copy these digital objects, these bits, from one medium to another, so at least you're on a medium you can still read. And then you discover that this digital object was created by a piece of software that no longer runs on the computer that you have. So now we're into a different kind of bit rot, the problem where we don't know how to interpret the bits even if we've carefully saved them.
Then they may as well not exist.
That's basically correct. For things that are static, an image or a text file, you can imagine ways of finding alternative software that might be able to render this stuff. But if it's a spreadsheet, which is an interactive program that will literally respond to new inputs, you really need the software.
So tell me about digital vellum.
Digital vellum is a term, actually, it's a made-up term, to try to draw people's attention to the need not only to physically preserve bits. Animal skins have turned out to be a pretty resilient way of storing written material, but also to preserve the executable environment so that software that created those bits can still be run. There's a project at Carnegie Mellon, which I learned about in the course of thinking through this digital vellum idea, Professor Mahadev Satyanarayanan. We call him Satya for obvious reasons. Basically, what he does is take a digital X-ray of the machine that has the operating system running and the application running, as well as a description of the way the hardware works. He's found a way to capture all that information and then reload it into, for example, into the cloud on a virtual machine that emulates whatever the older hardware was and runs the old operating system and application code. And so it's a brilliant piece of work. But there are some challenges that are not technical that are worth talking about.
Yeah, I can see one of them right now, and that is who would undertake such a project to be the clearinghouse for software, hardware, new and old? A private company like Google obviously has vast amounts of storage infrastructure, but I'm not sure whether the public wants all of the history of the internet stored in Google servers, and I'm not sure if your board of directors wants to pay for that. Then there's government, which raises the specter of a whole bunch of other things. Where does this stuff live?
Well, plainly, you have to have multiple organizations. It may very well turn out that no one institution either could or should be trusted to save everything forever. And look, there's a business model issue here. how do we make this an affordable kind of activity, one which is self-supporting or sustainable? And I don't think I have an answer to that, although it wouldn't surprise me if a combination of private sector, not-for-profit, and government institutions become a part of the solution. Just as you have libraries, some of which are supported by the federal government, some are supported by local governments, and some are private sector libraries. And so you can see that already in the older media that we have a diversity of investments in preserving information. And so if Google can do its part, it would only be a part of the solution.
Vint Cerf is Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist for Google. He disclaims being the father of the Internet, but it does kind of look like him.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm not the only father of the Internet. Bob Kahn and I did the original design way back in 1973. And then, of course, by this time, millions of people have contributed to its explosive growth. So I'm happy to accept a certain amount of visibility, but not all of it.
Vint, thank you so much.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you about this, and imagine that this might be digitized, and we can now ask ourselves, 1,000 years from now, will our descendants listen to this conversation and either say, boy, those guys were smart to figure out, you know, how to solve this problem, or too bad they didn't figure it out, and I'm listening to this because it was preserved by accident in a digitized piece of vellum.
Hi, this is Brandon from Sonoy, Georgia. My story begins when I was a senior in high school, and there was this girl I was trying to court, and I used the website MySpace. I remember coming home and really relishing logging onto MySpace and reading her letters and writing her letters. And eventually, I kind of figured I had outgrown MySpace, so I randomly kind of deleted my account. And when I told my girlfriend this, her name is Ashley, and we're now actually married. She immediately realized that these, you know, heralded love letters of our budding romance were gone forever. Even though we've been married for almost 3 years now, every time, you know, this comes up, she gets a little resentful that these letters are gone.
But as Bob earlier alluded to, it might not be technological obsolescence that divides us from our documents. The cause may not be in ourselves, but in our stars, or from our star in the form of a solar flare. In fact, we're experiencing a solar flare even as I record this.
A big solar storm has happened, and this level of geomagnetic storm is unusual. It occurs for approximately 60 days out of every 11 years.
This week's flare was large enough to paint the night skies over the Northeast and Midwest with colorful auroras, rarely seen beyond the extreme north and south poles of the planet. Smaller solar flares actually happen regularly, invisibly and harmlessly, but every once in a while, something massive happens. In the late summer of 1859, the English stargazer Richard Carrington was busily observing and analyzing solar flares and sunspots, as was his wont. All of a sudden, he saw the sun become dramatically brighter, a phenomenon rarely visible to the naked eye, and immediately grasping its importance, says astronomer Lucianne Walkowicz.
He ran off to go get somebody, and let this be a lesson to all budding astronomers. Never leave the telescope when something exciting is happening, because it was over when he got back. But the effects of the Carrington event were really quite astonishing. The main form of communications technology in 1859 was the telegraph. And this event actually induced currents in the telegraph wires that actually caused telegraph paper to catch on fire. The aurorae were so bright that in the northern latitudes you could read by them at night, and they were even seen down by the equator, which almost never happens.
Would you describe what a solar flare is?
Sure. Much like our planet has a magnetic field, the sun itself has a northern pole and a southern pole and magnetic field lines that come out of it. But the sun is not a solid object. The sun is essentially gaseous, and that means that the whole sun spins as a top, but different latitudes rotate at different rates. That causes the magnetic field lines to become tangled, almost like a twisted ball of yarn. And so the surface of the sun is actually speckled with these tangly-looking magnetic fields, which protrude from the surface and create these loops. Now, those loops themselves, again, like yarn or elastic or something like that, sometimes they snap. And the snapping of those field lines is what we know as a solar flare. This sometimes flings out actual material or the solar plasma in the form of what we call a coronal mass ejection.
Do we get chunks of the sun hitting Earth?
I don't like the word chunks just because it sounds like something almost like a meteor or something like that. Our planet has this magnetic field, which forms a sort of, you can think of it as a shark cage. So when we have that material fly off of the sun and come towards us, the magnetic field of the Earth deflects those particles down towards the poles of the planet. That can cause the actual atoms and molecules of our own atmosphere to glow or fluoresce. And so that's what we're seeing when we see the aurora borealis.
So that's really beautiful. But we also get things like blackouts.
When we have a solar flare, if you have magnetic material coming off the sun and it actually impacts with the planet, it can do things like induce currents in, you know, infrastructure here on Earth. And so sometimes that means relatively minor interruptions, but sometimes it can blow transformers and large parts of the power grid can go down.
I want to play you something. This is a clip from the History Channel's 2007 documentary series that was called The Universe. This is from the episode called Secrets of the Sun, and they cast the implications of a modern-day solar flare in a very dramatic light.
Imagine if we lost all the satellites that relay cell phone calls, television signals, and bank transactions. And what if, at the same time, the failure of power grids cascaded whole regions into darkness for hours or weeks? If these essential services couldn't be restored quickly, chaos wouldn't be far behind.
Dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria. No, seriously, do you think they're gilding the lily here a little?
Well, I mean, I think it's fair enough to ask what would happen if all of those things happened. Personally, I take a scientific approach. Let's not find out. Let's make sure that, you know, in the case of a large solar flare, it would be unlikely that, for example, your laptop would get fried because your laptop is probably plugged into a surge protector. But the ability to transmit data doesn't do you any good if you don't have any power with which to do so.
Mm-hmm.
The other aspect to this is not just, you know, whether you blow a transformer on the ground. It's also that we all rely on satellites for communication now quite a bit. You know, GPS relies on satellites. There are things that we can do to mitigate the damage, but how long it takes to get it back depends on how powerful it is and what we've done in the interim to make sure that we're prepared.
The History Channel documentary also suggested that solar flares are as difficult to predict as hurricanes.
I would say that it's probably easier to predict hurricanes than it is to predict solar flares. We have what we call a solar cycle. Every 22 years, essentially, the sun goes through a very active phase where it has lots of sunspots, lots of solar flares. Over the following 11 years, it goes into what we call a solar minimum, where it might still have flares occasionally, it might occasionally have spots, but essentially, you know, all's quiet on the Western Front. So now we're actually going into a solar minimum where it will be less likely that there will be flares, although there won't be zero. And we do actually devote a fair amount of research resources to trying to predict that. You know, what we can do is be prepared to the extent that we can be prepared. But, you know, I used to live in California and I didn't spend every day worrying about whether there was going to be an earthquake. I just made sure that I had batteries, a flashlight, and fresh water.
But do we have the equivalent of those things in terms of generating power through bicycle wheels and the sort of thing that wouldn't require the sun? Sticking an electrode into a potato.
Yeah, I think you're going to need a lot of bikes and a lot of potatoes. Maybe we should just make sure the power grid doesn't go down.
Lucianne, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Lucianne Wolkowicz is an astronomer at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago.
The residents of Quebec discovered the implications of solar flares in 1989. When they experienced a series of blackouts from which the power company struggled to recover. This from the CBC archive.
There was a sudden power surge in northern Quebec, just a fraction of a second. And then, like a big circuit breaker, the whole system shut down. They don't know, but they suspect it may have something to do with solar flares. Over the last week, scientists have recorded some of the largest flares this century.
Count IT specialist Rocky Rollins among those haunted by the idea that a modern-day sequel to Carrington could have devastating consequences. Rollins is the founder of a website called SurvivorLibrary.com, And he says we've been warned of the sun's destructive potential as recently as 2012.
That was almost as large as the Carrington event. Fortunately, it missed us. If it had hit us, we'd be living in the 1800s right now. What got me started in this was when I used to work for the government, and we had to deal with making sure that computers were tempest-hardened so that they would survive an EMP effect in case there was a nuclear exchange in a war.
EMP, that's electromagnetic pulse.
Exactly. A nuclear weapon explosion creates an electromagnetic pulse, which generates current, high amperage current, in any kind of electrical circuit it hits. In 2001, Congress set up a committee primarily concerned with what would happen if a rogue nation like North Korea or Iran got hold of a nuclear weapon and used it to launch an EMP attack on the United States by detonating a high-altitude nuclear weapon. Then they also began to understand that there was the potential of a solar-caused EMP.
Now, you can sort of negotiate with North Korea. You can't negotiate with the sun.
Exactly.
What did Congress, in its wisdom, decide to do about that kind of scenario?
Up till now, they've done nothing. The UK is taking it seriously enough that they built an alternate navigation system for their merchant fleets in case the GPS satellites are damaged or destroyed so that their ships will be able to navigate, which ours won't be.
If you were the president, what would you do to protect us against electromagnetic pulses?
Spend about $3 billion and harden the power grid. We don't keep backup transformers. They come from Europe and they take a year to make. Simply by shielding the transformers on our power grid, it would ensure that even if everything else went down, the power grid would stay up. And if the power grid stays up, that's 90% of the battle right there. Several congressmen and senators have put forward bills to protect the grid. So far, it's never even made it to a vote or a committee.
So tell me about the Survivor Library. What's in it?
Mostly books that range from the early 1800s through the early 1900s. Essentially, it's a codex of knowledge and skills and technology as it existed before the widespread use of electronics. Pretty much everything you would need to know to rebuild an 1800s, early 1900s industrial and technological infrastructure.
So you navigate not by GPS, but by sextant and dead reckoning.
Right.
And what else is in there?
Medical books, how to build steam engines, how to operate steam locomotives, how to build sailing ships, how to build a lumber mill using water power, how to plow a field with a mule instead of a tractor, how to build simple airplanes.
You got livestock sheep, livestock swine, medical anesthesia, pottery, poultry, printing, embalming. What's the coolest category in this archive?
It's hard to say. I mean, every time I come across a new one, that one becomes the most fascinating for a while. Like right now, I'm just putting a meteorology group up there, which is everything you need to know to do weather predictions and weather forecasting without radars and satellites.
There's a category for morality.
Exactly.
The Elements of Moral Science, 1865, The Crisis in Morals, 1891, mm-hmm. and Principles of Religion and Morality from 1807. This is really one-stop shopping for building a society.
I've read a lot of these books, or at least looked through them in great depth. I do not want to live in the 1800s. Heaven forbid. I know too much from reading these books what living in the 1800s was like. It was a harsh and brutal period of time compared to today. But if an EMP event occurs, living in the 1800s and early 1900s is a lot better than reverting to the 1400s or 1500s, which is what we would have for a while.
One last thing, Rocky.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say there's a solar storm, electromagnetic pulses that fry everything. We rush to our computers. We type in survivorlibrary.com, but, dude, the network is down.
We've got, at this point, it looks like about 7,000 people downloading these books just off of my site. Most of the people downloading these things are doing what we're all doing. We're dumping copies of them on DVDs or CDs or small portable hard drives.
taking those and a spare laptop and shoving them in a Faraday cage in a closet someplace just in case. And even if an EMP event occurred, probably some of the computers would survive. Then you've got a community project where people start bringing these books up, dumping them to printers, binding them, putting covers on them, labeling them, putting them on shelves, and start building a physical library that everybody in the community can use.
Build some furniture, embalm the dead, and do it all morally. Rocky, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Rocky Rollins works in IT support for an online retailer. He is the archivist and creator of SurvivorLibrary.com.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If by now you've become a little anxious about the vulnerability of your own digital histories, just be glad you're not working at the European Bioinformatics Institute in England. The Institute offers a free storage service to genomic researchers around the world. They have a 60 petabyte storage capacity. But between equipment maintenance and the explosive growth of genomic data to be stored, the service is just getting too expensive to continue. So Dr. Nick Goldman, a mathematician and genome scientist at the Institute, and his colleague Ewan Burney came up with a solution. Goldman tells it like this.
Two scientists walk into a pub and say, isn't DNA, which is the root of all our problems, itself a digital storage medium for information? And we said, well, what's stopping us from taking anything digital and putting it into a form where we can represent it as though it was a bit of DNA, then actually make that DNA, read it back just the way we read the genomes of living organisms now, and put the raw information back together again?
That sounds like one uproarious pub night.
Amongst scientists like us, it was pretty good.
So this is organic storage, right? How do you do it?
Well, the information it's storing is held by a code that knows how to interpret the sequence of bases. So the bases are conveniently represented by the letters A, C, G, and T. So one very simple code using A, C, G, and T would allow us to write cat and not very much else. But as long as we make up some more complicated rules, we can store pretty much any information. Just like if we only use zeros and ones, it lets us just store some very simple numbers. But if we make a complicated code, it can store music. And we call that complicated code MP3. Mm-hmm. And what Ewan and myself eventually invented was a code that can take any digital file on a computer and represent it as letters A, C, G, and T. Then we get that made as actual physical DNA.
We're not talking about live DNA, right? I mean, this isn't a vial of blood containing the Magna Carta. This is more like dust.
It looks like dust, but in fact, it's a chemical molecule that is a chain of smaller molecules, and we're using it in a very similar way to the way living organisms use it, but we're not involving living organisms. There would be enormous ethics issues about trying to do that. And also, it's a very bad way to store information, to put it into a living organism that's constantly copying that information and making occasional mistakes. Much better to just put the information in a form where it doesn't mutate.
Not to mention the fact that living organisms eventually die of old age, and this stuff can retain its information for tens of thousands of years, potentially.
Particularly if you keep it cold and dry and in the dark, scientists were able to extract DNA and put back together large parts of the genomes of 750,000-year-old ancient horses. And that wasn't even a carefully prepared sample, right? That was just a dead horse.
Okay, give me an image of how much space it takes to store digital information in DNA form.
An estimate of all the digital information in the whole world, everything that's connected to the internet, if you stored that much information purely in DNA using the system we devised, you could fit all of it in the back of a minivan. The big bottleneck for us is the cost of creating an information archive in DNA. In the last 15 years since the human genome was first sequenced, there's been a millionfold improvement in the price and the speed of doing that. If the next 15 years sees another millionfold improvement, and if we also get that improvement in the creation of DNA, then we have a product that private individuals will use to store information they want kept really safe, whether it's, you know, wedding photographs or the presidential archives or records on nuclear waste dumps. Those will be more than affordable in 10 or 15 years. And we think in 3 or 4 years for some of the customers who would pay the most for the most valuable information.
Now, we're talking to you as part of a show we're doing on the potential digital dark age. Picture one of those ancient tomb raiding films.
Yep.
It is now 10,000 years into the future, and man has apparently wiped out its store of knowledge and had to start all over again. And then they stumble upon one of your storage facilities. What clues would you give them about how they could access once again the world of human culture?
We have thought about this. You know, the Voyager spacecraft was sent with messages for aliens we hadn't quite imagined to try and tell them something about people on Earth. And what you need to do is you need to send someone a signal that says there is important information hidden here. We build this storage facility and we put big pictures that show double helix diagrams and, you know, some arrows saying the information is in here. You know, if they're technologically advanced, they're going to be into reading DNA because we will rediscover the knowledge that that's where the information about life is stored.
Let us concede, it took us quite a while.
It took us a while, but, you know, we got there. It took us a few thousand years. Maybe it'll be a bit quicker next time. You wanted me to play the game.
Yes, it's taken,
I admit it's taken a long time. And then we'll have to make sure they can understand the code that's being used. And there we'd use the same kind of strategy as for Voyager. You pick bits of information to store first that you make the easiest things to decode, that just let people know they're on the right track. You encode something that's information about the structure of a hydrogen atom, because everyone will have discovered hydrogen. And then you give a series of successively more complicated messages, the last one of which explains in full your coding and decoding system. And then that gives access to the last room in this storage facility, which has got the entire archive of human knowledge encoded in DNA. And you just let people go.
Where do you think this hypothetical storage facility would be?
A mountainside in Norway or the Antarctic might be a good one, because there's a number of treaties already there about protecting it. So maybe we could piggyback on those and get some international cooperation going about having an information store.
Dr. Goldman, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure. It's been great to talk to you.
Dr. Nick Goldman is a mathematician and genome scientist at the European Bioinformatics Institute in Cambridge, England. This month, he sprinkled the public with some of his DNA pixie dust. He and artist Charlotte Jarvis collaborated with the Kreutzer Quartet for a series of performances in London called Music of the Spheres. The composition is made up of two verses and a refrain that was coded into DNA dust, sudsed up and then released, bathing the audience with DNA music bubbles. Right now you're hearing Fibers and Coils, composed by Mihailo Trandafilovsky.
My name is Meredith, and I'm calling from Phoenix. When I went to Oberlin College, I decided to be a composition major. At that time, everything that I composed, I would have audio tapes of. And I have the audio tapes, but I have nothing to play them on, and I regret that. I have one piece in particular that I wrote that goes through my head a lot that I wish I could listen to.
The Svalbard Vault in Norway, just over 800 miles from the North Pole, preserves a global seed bank in case of environmental disaster. Now, another kind of vault is under construction in Norway, a literary one,
which is why we're talking to Margaret Atwood. She's known for her dystopian novels like The Handmaid's Tale and the Mad Adam trilogy, which starts with Oryx and Crake. Her most recent novel, The Heart Goes Last, comes out this fall. But actually, her latest work, called Scribbler Moon, won't come out for another 99 years because Atwood is the first author to contribute a manuscript to a project called The Future Library, based in Norway. 100 writers each will contribute one work to the collection that will be published in 2114.
Your text has to be made of words, no images. Any length, it can be one word, it can be 1,000 pages, and you can't tell anybody what's in it.
The next contributor will be English novelist David Mitchell, who wrote Cloud Atlas and The Bone Clocks. His work will be published in 99 years, the next author in 98 years, and so on. So the last author will just have to wait 1 year.
That's right, and there's going to be a lot more pressure on that person.
Scottish artist Katie Patterson chose you as the first of the 100 authors to contribute to the Future Library. Isn't part of it because you have spent so much of your literary life envisioning the future in such disquieting ways?
It might be partly that. And it wasn't just her. There's an invitational committee. I think they wanted people who were interested in time, technology, the future, and the sort of person who might like to take a chance. Roll the dice, or maybe go to Comic-Con, which I have done.
I'm so struck by the fact that this project is so tangible, so palpable. 1,000 trees growing for 100 years to print 3,000 copies of 100 manuscripts. The Future Library also includes instructions on how to make paper. There's a printing press, again with instructions in case we forgot how to do that.
And she's also selling certificates as part of the funding for this that entitle you or your heirs and assigns to collect in 100 years a copy of this book.
Yeah, they cost £600 each, right?
They do. They're like a deed. They entitle you to the book should your progeny managed to pass it down from hand to hand.
The New York Times described the project as the literary equivalent of a seed bank. Did you approach your contribution with that in mind, that this might persist as a kind of safe haven for literature in case all else fails?
Well, any time you write something, you're always anticipating a future reader. Just as when you write down a musical score, you're anticipating a future player who will come along and unlock the score and turn it back into music again. A seed bank is the same idea. You put the seeds in there with the idea that somebody will, in the future, plant them.
I'm just wondering if there was a difference writing for readers who aren't born yet.
Are we talking about the idea of me maybe dying? Is that the subject here? Any book, when you write it, there's always a time gap between when you write it and when somebody else reads it. It's just that the time gap is a little bit longer. Well, be frank, quite a lot longer.
But didn't you say that readers might need a paleoanthropologist to enjoy the book?
Yeah, we know how language changes over time. And we know that words are appearing all the time. Words are changing their meanings all of the time. We know that we can still understand Shakespeare, though the further along in time we go, the more footnotes we need. Maybe the languages themselves will be extinct in 100 years. And if so, should they be putting in a dictionary?
In Oryx and Crake, Crake says, "All it takes is the elimination of one generation of anything, beetles, trees, microbes, scientists, speakers of French, whatever. Break the link in time between one generation and the next, and it's game over forever."
I'm afraid so.
What do you think the world's going to be like in 100 years?
Well, now, the good news from the physicists is that time really does move in one direction. things aren't all simultaneous the way they were in Slaughterhouse-Five. So choices you make now actually can influence the future. The bad news is that Donald Rumsfeld was right about one thing. It's the unknown unknowns that get you. So we don't know about the unknown unknowns. We know about some of the knowns. We know that our actions can change some of those knowns. I just read in the paper today that the cod fishery has rebounded.
That is actually very encouraging.
Don't you think? Something has rebounded. We hear about all these things bounding, but we don't hear about them rebounding. So the other thing that's helpful is that there's a great endeavor underway to plant a lot of milkweed so that the monarch butterflies will rebound. And a man has discovered that one of the biggest soakers up of oil spills is actually milkweed fluff that he's making into oil spill sucker uppers. And he's got a bunch of farmers growing milkweed for this project. So people are very ingenious and they come up with all kinds of solutions.
You know, I have to admit, I'm a little taken aback by how positive you sound. Your imagined worlds are so dystopian.
It's not all bad. Duct tape has survived the meltdown of the human race. It's very positive. The thing about my books is they're books. And just think of it this way. We've known how for decades to blow ourselves up with atomic bombs, and we haven't done it yet.
And so it now makes sense to me why you told the Guardian newspapers a few years back when asked what your favorite word was. Do you remember what you replied?
Oh, something stupid, I suppose.
No.
What was it?
You said your favorite word was and.
It's a good word.
It's so hopeful, you said.
Yeah, an and. I think it's better than therefore.
Not nearly as prescriptive. A character in The Blind Assassin said, "Why is it we want so badly to memorialize ourselves? Even while we're still alive, we wish to assert our existence like dogs peeing on fire hydrants. We monogram our linen, we carve our names on trees, we scrawl them on washroom walls. What do we hope to get from it?" And you said, or the character said, "We can't stand the idea of our own voices falling silent like a radio running down."
Is what she says true?
Is it?
Is it? I'm asking you. You're the reader.
It sounds right, and I guess that's the impulse for writing. But when you're staring 100 years from now in the face...
I think it's very hard to imagine yourself not existing, because even in the sentence in which you say, "I will not exist," there's still an I.
So what about the digital dark age?
What happened during the dark ages? Is that going to happen to our current modern times, in which a lot of information will just be lost? So that's why you should be carefully scribbling in your diary on paper.
Do you worry about that?
You know, people keep using this word worry. Young people worry a lot more than older people. And the reason they worry a lot more than older people is that they don't know the plot of their own lives yet. They don't know how it's going to turn out for them. At my age, and I am starting to sound like one of those people who says, "at my age," at my age, I kind of know how the story goes. So should I get hit by a truck tomorrow, the plot will pretty much have unfolded.
And the rest of the human race?
Well, of course I worry about them, but they have to worry about themselves because it's not going to be my problem very shortly.
Margaret Atwood, thank you very much.
And thank you very much. How old are you anyway?
60.
Oh, you're a mere child.
Yeah, right.
No wonder you're so worried.
Actually, less and less every day.
Yeah, this is what I mean. Yeah, I could have been your babysitter and popped you into the microwave. No, I take that back.
They didn't have microwaves when
no,
I was
there. No, they didn't. Yes. I thought you might spot that.
Margaret Atwood's latest collection of short fiction is out in paperback now, called Stone Mattress, Nine Wicked Tales. A new novel, The Heart Goes Last, comes out this fall, and Scribbler Moon comes out in 2114. published by the Future Library in Oslo.
My name is Jacob, and I'm calling from Stockholm, Sweden. I lost everything in 2005, all of my digital files, and basically my life when I moved to Costa Rica to be part of a business deal that went bad. And at first I was terrified because I had absolutely nothing. But I went back to my home in Texas and stayed with my parents for a few months. And I applied for jobs to work as an English teacher in Korea. And I started a brand new life with nothing. With no money, with no digital past, with no yearbooks, with no class ring, with no photographs. And it was the best decision of my life because my life before that period was sad and heavy and burdened. However, by losing everything, I could start over again. So losing the past is not always something to lament. It could be a possibility to celebrate.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Kasia Mihailovic, and Sam Dingman. We had more help from Jenna Cagle and Maya Brownstein, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson, and our engineer this week was Greg Rippon.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.